I was a little confused by Randy called me and I was.
But show it to me, but we have it. Ours are all.
They're all regulated. Yeah.
Hello. Today is Friday, February 6, 2015. I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And before we start, I'd like to inform everyone that we will actually not hear House Bill 2114. That will be re-referred to Business and Labor Committee. And there is actually a House Bill 2116 that will be referred to this committee. It's the dependent care tax credit, and it was not yet referred to us. So we considered delaying all of this so that we could hear all the appropriate ones together, but this was all about an hour ago. We knew you're on your way, so we decided to go ahead. Just know this conversation will continue, and we will be re-examining all of these with 2116 down the road. So I'd like to open a work session to
public hearing.
Public hearing?
Yeah, we're
gonna we're going to go right to that.
Skip that, yeah. We don't have any of these.
Oh, I was going to open a work session if we had any committee bills to introduce for adoption. We still do not yet, but as you know, we are open to having that anytime. Let us know if you would like to introduce any bills as a committee bill and propose it to the committee for adoption.
My apologies.
Okay. I will now open a public hearing on House Bill. We're going to start at the bottom, 2115. And should I call up?
Oh, yeah, I can give the summary. My apologies.
We're going to have a summary from our committee administrator. And then we'll be calling up Chris, and let's hear from revenue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2115 extends tax credit sunset for working family child care credit. It may have a revenue impact, no statement is issued yet. It may have a fiscal impact, no statement issued yet. And there's a subsequent referral to the joint tax committee.
So
Chris and Deanna.
So thank you, Chris and Deanna, for starting us off. For a refresher for all of us and for everyone in the audience and on air. Could you please state your name for the record and also could just give us an overview of, as you did last time, all of the child care tax credit bills, how we are supposed to look at this, just a quick summary, and then go to 2115.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And the very cliff notes synopsis of the four child care tax credits that are before the legislature this session. There are two consumer tax credits, one employer tax credit, and one that I've labeled a regulation tax credit. The two consumer child care tax credits are the child and dependent care credit. It's a piggyback of a federal credit.
If that's number 2116?
That's 2116.
Okay.
The working family child care credit, which is 2115. Then there is the employer-provided dependent care assistance credit, which is the 2114, and that's the one that will be swapped, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one, I think, is 2113. It is the tax credit for contributions to the Office of Child Care. And so...
And the 2091, how do you characterize that?
2091 is... It's related to 2115.
Mm-hmm.
2115 extends the sunset date for the working family child care credit by 6 years. It's kind of the placeholder bill. It doesn't do any policy change. It just extends it for 6 years. House Bill 2091 doubles the working family child care credit, and it does so for only 1 year for tax year 2015. It doesn't extend the sunset date.
Okay, thank you. So it's actually referring to the same tax credit. It's just the expansion as opposed to the extension.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, I did have... In part following up from questions from the other day, I did have a two-pager to kind of walk through the mechanics of how the federal child and dependent care credit and the Oregon child and dependent care credit and the working family child care credit, and included an example of a family that could claim all three. I don't know if you want me to go through that or if you want it to...
I think it would be great. And this is in the materials?
Yes, it should be in the bullets. Okay. To start there, it's titled Child Care Consumer Tax Credits. And the first one, the Federal Child Independent Care Credit. It's a credit for the taxpayer if he or she pays someone to care for a dependent under the age of 13 or a spouse or dependent who was unable to care for themselves. The credit is up to 35% of eligible expenses, and those expenses are capped at $3,000 for one child or $6,000 for two or more children. And following up on some of the questions were going Wednesday, I've actually included some of these tables here just to get familiar with the terminology of phase downs and phase outs. That's a lot of the tax lingo that the folks on the Revenue Committee are familiar with, but I'm not sure how far that familiarity extends. So this is the federal phase down schedule. As federal AGI increases from $15,000 up to $43,000, the share of eligible expenses, the credit share declines from 35% to 20%. And we call this a phase down because once federal AGI hits $43,000, then 20% of those eligible expenses are allowed as a credit. So there is no income limit. So the credit falls, and then it stays at a floor of 20%. And so then the last two columns there are simply the maximum credit if you have one dependent or two dependents. And that is simply the $3,000 multiplied by that percentage or the $6,000 multiplied by that percentage. So that's kind of the core structure of that tax credit. The Oregon Child Independent Care Credit is one where Oregon taxpayers are eligible if they qualify for the federal credit. And the Oregon credit is up to 30% of eligible expenses. And this is where some of the technicalities can get a little bit confusing because the phase-out schedule for the Oregon credit is federal taxable income, not federal AGI. So the difference between those two, at a very simple level, AGI would be the sum of a taxpayer's wages. You take away their federal exemption, you subtract their federal exemptions and their deductions, and then you get to federal taxable income.
I just want to point out, because I didn't see it at first, it's under OLIS, under Materials for Today, under Chris Olenek. Can everyone see what he's talking about? So Christopher Olenek, so it's a medium, it says House Human Services, final.
Because we care what you're saying, are we doing this?
Yeah, trying to follow the graph that you're talking about.
Okay, well, I'll try to find it.
No problem.
Thank you.
So it's the chart.
No, I guess I'm not. I was wrong. We're both wrong.
We're new at this.
It's okay.
Bear with us. I want people to be able to see what you're doing.
I shouldn't have started.
Well, you can share mine.
Click on this. Okay. So now we'll go ahead and click on. Click on the meeting.
Okay. Scroll up. Press that.
Okay. And then click on this one.
Materials.
Human Housing Services. Uh-huh.
And then go and do this one. Chris. There.
Okay.
Do you have a representative?
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. It's easier to follow when you can look at a lot of numbers. Okay. So you were on the second graph? The Oregon
Well, were there any questions about the first table?
Okay.
All of this, Madam Chair, is really just a lead up to the example and to introduce some of the terminology.
Great.
Okay, so that was it. Any questions on that first table? Okay, the second table is for the Oregon Child Independent Care Credit, which is the 30% of eligible expenses. Now, where the policies can get a little bit confusing is that the phase-out, so the phase-out structure is the same. So income up to from $5,000 to $45,000, we have a step-down or a phase-out of the Oregon credit, where it goes from 30% to 15% and eventually down to zero. So that's what we refer to as a phase-out. And then the maximum credit in the other two columns is just that percentage times either the $3,000 eligible expenses or the $6,000 eligible expenses. One of the key notes here in it is that this phase out is federal taxable income, whereas the federal program is phased down on federal AGI. And again, AGI, for example, is the sum of a household's wages. And then when somebody fills out these are both tax return terms. AGI would be the household wages. Mm-hmm. And then when some taxpayer calculates their taxes, they start there. They subtract personal exemptions and personal deductions, and then they get federal taxable income. Mm-hmm. So taxable income is AGI after deductions.
And when you say AGI for wages, it also includes earned income, all income, right?
All of it. Not there just there wages. Are right. 15 or so categories of income.
Okay. Yeah.
So on the next page is the Working Family Child Care Credit. And so this is the one that is touched by House Bills 2115 and 2091. So this is a refundable Oregon tax credit for taxpayers for qualifying child care expenses. And the child must be under 13 or have a disability to find an Oregon statute. And this has income requirements where there has to be a minimum amount of earned income of $8,550 in 14. It's indexed to inflation. And a maximum amount of unearned income, $3,550. And I believe a member had an example of some unearned income that kicks somebody out of eligibility for that tax credit. This credit is up to 40% of eligible expenses. And for this credit, there is no cap on the eligible expenses. So that's a difference between the other two credits. And this one is phased out between 200% and 250% of the federal poverty level. So the department publishes a number of tables depending, because the federal poverty level depends on the household size. So the one table I've included in here is for household size 3 for 2014. And so the federal AGI between $39,600 to $49,500, the credit percentage is phased out, 40% to 36 to 32, and then eventually down to zero. And so if we assume eligible expenses for the year of $10,800, then the credit is in those numbers. So at the 40% level, it would be $4,320. And then you can see how that number phases out to zero as income increases. So the example that we have here is a single parent with two children, child care expenses, a monthly amount of $900, and that's where so the annual amount is $10,800. So their only income is wages, and that's $48,000. So if we look at the federal column, that's their AGI, $48,000. And then we take away their deductions, which at the federal level are the personal exemptions and standard deduction. That amounts to $20,950. And then their taxable income is $27,050 at the federal level. Their gross tax, so that $27,000 gets applied to the federal tax rates, and their gross tax is $3,410. And their federal child and dependent care credit is $1,200. By looking back up into that other table, you'd find out the percentage, multiply it by the $6,000, and their credit is $1,200. Mm-hmm. Now we turn to the Oregon tax return. We have the same $48,000 of wages, or AGI. Their deductions are only $3,615. That's the standard deduction. And the note, the asterisk there, is meant to denote the I was expecting questions about the difference there. And at the federal level, there is a personal exemption that's taken at this level. In Oregon, we have a personal exemption credit. Mm-hmm. So it's taken after the gross tax is calculated. Mm-hmm. So the taxable income for Oregon is $44,385. And applying Oregon's tax rates, we get a gross tax of $3,533. And then based on these characteristics, their Oregon Child and Dependent Care Credit would be $300. Again, looking up into that table. So the table on the other side, the federal taxable income is $27,000. So on that other table, the 27 falls between the 25,000 and the 35,000. So their credit percentage is 5%.
Hmm. Even though that's federal... So you don't look at this, you look at this for that?
That's one of the quirks. In some of the tables that we were looking at on Wednesday, there was information that said mm-hmm. it phases out, jumping back to the federal child and dependent care credit, it phases out at $45,000 of income, mm-hmm. and that's taxable income. Mm-hmm. And there are statistics that show that people with over $50,000 of income are claiming the credit. And that's because that $50,000 of income is AGI. Mm-hmm. The common way of reporting these kinds of credit, these statistics, is by using AGI, because that's the most common form of, mm-hmm. of income that people think of. Okay. So this dissonance between AGI and taxable income is where these odd things can show up in some of the tables.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, based on these numbers and this example, so this single parent of two children has a gross tax of $3,400 or $3,500. Combined, they're going to end up receiving $4,092 back between federal and state. So the amount that
Madam Chair, yeah. Vice Chair Stark. The bottom line there is, so just if some getting to the, let me finishing that up quickly. The working family child care credit would be $864, that same possibility. That bottom line would be the working family child care credit under House Bill 2091.
So it'd be one or the other?
And one or the other.
Okay.
Current law would be the 864. The proposed law would be the 1728 instead of the 864.
Right, yeah. Okay.
So that's probably as clear as mud.
Any other questions? Yeah, no, this is really helpful.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. These are really helpful. Thank you for all that work since last time.
Sure.
Do you want to go on?
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Deanna Mack. I'm with the Oregon Department of Revenue. And I was here to, I went back and listened to the hearing on Wednesday, and I understand you had a lot of technical questions about the bill and how people qualify for the bill. So I'm here to help you understand what the qualifiers are. If you so desire, I can go over them if you'd like, for the Child and Dependent Care Credit as well as the Working Family Credit in a little bit more detail than not as maybe as wonky as that information was. But what people have to see on the tax returns and how they learn that they qualify.
Okay, that would be great.
Okay. So for the Child and Dependent Care Credit, you have to have eligible expenses. You have to have work-related expenses, so they have to be for you to work or your spouse to work or go to school. And you cannot pay expenses to someone that you claim as a dependent on your return. So they're generally, you have to identify the tax care provider or the child care provider, and you also are limited on a number of expenses you can claim. Chris mentioned the $3,000 and the $6,000. I don't know if you're familiar with flexible spending accounts, but a lot of people can put their expenses in pre-tax. If you do make use of that, then you have to reduce your $3,000 and $6,000 limit by the amount that you claim pre-tax. So there are some special rules there, but generally, the dependent is someone that you can, is usually your child under age 16 or a spouse who cannot physically or mentally take care of themselves, or any person who lives with you more than half the year who cannot take care of themselves physically or mentally. So anyone who qualifies for those standards would be a qualifying person for the return for the Child and Dependent Care Credit. You must have earned income of some amount. The credit is limited to, you can't have a credit that's greater than your earned income. And earned income is wages, salaries, tips, commissions, those kinds of things. Earned income is not Social Security or retirement benefits, that kind of stuff. Generally, you must file a joint return if you are married. There are some special rules around that for the Child and Dependent Care Credit. For the Working Family Child Care Credit, there is a limit, a minimum requirement of earned income. You have to have at least, I think Chris mentioned, $8,550. So there's a difference. One, you don't have to have a minimum. The other, you do. And you can't make more than the $3,350 on earned income. So I think Chris kind of went over those main things. But I think the questions that you really had to do with the types of expenses that qualified and so I'll go over those, and they're the same for both credits. The qualifying expenses, of course, have to be for you to work, your spouse to work, or you to actively look for work, or to go to school. You can be self-employed and qualify, or you can be an employee. Either one works as long as you have earned income. So traditional daycare that you, you know, daycare centers, that kind of thing, those expenses are okay. What's not okay is food, lodging, clothing, and education, entertainment, those kinds of things, unless they're so embedded in the price that you can't discern them out. Child support payments that you pay to the custodial parent don't count as payments towards child care expenses. So, for example, education is one of those where sometimes it is allowed and sometimes it isn't. Education expenses for preschool age children are allowed because they're not required to go to school. But once they're in kindergarten and higher, you can't pay for tuition at a private school or something like that and qualify for child independent care credit or working family child care credit. Camp, you can send your child to a day camp, but you cannot send your child to an overnight camp and qualify. The idea is that, you have to be looking for work or attending school, and so daytime is usually the rule there. Transportation costs, I believe you had questions about that last Wednesday, and the transportation costs are not allowed for the parent, but the child, the provider of the care, if they have to transport kids to and from school, those kinds of costs are eligible. So if you have to pay for those for your provider, those are okay. And then if you have to pay a deposit to your provider for their services in advance, you can claim that, but you cannot claim forfeited deposits. So if you leave their employer, whatever, in the end, you cannot claim those as qualified expenses. And then lastly, household services. If you have a housekeeper, a maid, or a cook, as long as they are at least partly caring for the well-being and protection of a qualifying person, the chauffeur, the bartender, the gardener, those expenses are not okay. So those are, I think the high level information that you had asked about last week, earlier on Wednesday. So if you have any other questions about how the credit work, I might be able to answer some technical questions for you.
Okay.
If you have
any technical questions, any numbers?
Excellent.
Thank you. Okay, so I'd like to call up Chuck Shekatoff first. And this is for House Bill 2115, but I invite you to put it in the context of the history of ERDC and the various different tax credits.
Sure.
And then to the extent you want to give your comment on 2115 and whether we should continue the sunset, do that. I'm guessing that I need to close that and open it up if you want to be talking about other ones as well. But for the begin, you'll have to give me direction on that.
Okay, if we can pause for just a moment.
Yep.
Thanks.
I have to figure out the protocol.
I understand.
But I, as long as you're talking generally about the tax credits in ERDC and the history of them, I think we're fine under calling it 2115. Try not to break too many rules. Testifying on 2115, you are welcome to give the broader context of the history and all the different tax credits, but the minute you start giving testimony on the other ones, wait, and we will call you up and do each of those one by one when you want to talk about your public testimony about whether it should go forward or not and how.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Chuck Shekatoff, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. So I'm here in support of extending the sunset on House Bill 2115, and I'll stay at that. But I want to give context to the legislation I was involved when it was created back in 1997. I'll start, though, in 1988 when Congress passed what was called the Family Support Act, and it changed what was then the Adult Aid to Families with Dependent Children, or Aid to Dependent Children in Oregon, the welfare cash welfare program. It was a program pushed by then-Governor Bill Clinton to try to get people to go from welfare to work. Oregon went wholeheartedly into the Family Support Act, and that Family Support Act created state programs called the JOBS program, and JOBS stands for Job Opportunities and Basic Skills. And so when you came into state welfare, when you got onto the ADC program, you were put into the JOBS program, and which was capped at its funding. It wasn't an entitlement like ADC. And you were given training and barrier removal and things so you could get into the workforce. Oregon went wholehearted into it and got up to the maximum amount of federal dollars and had a human investment model where they were saying, look, we're not going to just push people into the workforce. If you have barriers, we're going to remove them, like alcohol or drug treatment needs. If you don't have a high school degree, we're going to make sure you at least have a GED before we put you into the workforce and the like. As a part of that, go forward a few years, then the whole, on the national level and here in Oregon, started having debates about welfare reform. Bill Clinton was president. He had run on the issue. And so there was a lot of presentations in the Ways and Means subcommittees on Human Services about what happens in your welfare to work program. And we were very proud of our JOBS program. It had been evaluated by what was called the MDRC, the Manpower Demonstration Research Corporation, showing that we were doing a good job, and we were compared to some other states that weren't doing human capital investment. And we were seeing the caseload go down. We were watching how many people got jobs, what the wages they were, how long they were staying off public assistance. And throughout that process, people kept saying, as part of the debate, is welfare better than work? Is work better than welfare? And so the welfare agency at the time, Adult and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. Mm-hmm. I'll try not to use lots of initials if I can. I sometimes fall trap into that, though, and you will all learn a lot this session. they kept showing that work was always better than welfare. Back in the early 90s, it was always better, and it is today. And they would say, well, what happens to all the different benefit programs? And they would do these charts showing what happened to your food stamps, your ADC, and federal earned income tax credit as you left welfare. And they did not include the federal child and dependent care credit because most low-income people don't get it. They weren't using those type of care that would qualify. And they were showing what was happening on the state level, that it was better. Then we got to 1997, mm-hmm. and then Senate President Brady Adams, a banker from Grants Pass, said, I've seen this chart. It's not right that you don't get all your money as you start going up. It sort of levels out. Work is better than welfare, but as you go up the income scale, you're not getting all the gains. I want to do something about it. And he turned to the Senate Revenue Committee Chair, Ken Baker from Clackamas County, and said, I want you to spend $100 million to solve this problem. And I want you to spend it in an out biennium, not next biennium, an out biennium, so that you're debating the policy, not whether or not this policy is better than funding K-12 or whatever. And he also said, I'd like you to look at child care and the earned income tax credit. The earned income tax credit had been, having a state one had been, people were lobbying for it for many years, especially from people from the faith community, Bob Castagna from the Catholic Conference and Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and whatnot. So then the committee started looking at it, and they wanted to do both, have a state earned income tax credit and do something about child care. And folks who know a lot about child, I was not with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. We had not been born then, but I was with Legal Services. But some people who do research on child care came in and said, look, our low-income people don't get to really use the child independent care credit, and it's not refundable. So if they have low taxes, they don't get the full benefit of it anyway. You should have a special credit that meets the needs of low-income working families. So, and I can still remember at one point that they said, like, for instance, one of the examples given, you know, some low-income families, they'll pay the mother of the kid, will pay her mother, the grandmother of the child, to do child care. And you know, it's, and there is a financial arrangement for that, and that's the informal care they're in, and they should get a tax credit for that, making that payment. And I remember Senator Vern Duncan was on the committee, and he said, yeah, you know, I take care of my grandchildren, I don't charge, but I can imagine that people charge, and we should let people get, if that's a cost, that's a legitimate cost for a very low-income person. So they wanted it to really help meet the needs of the lowest income people who were entering the workforce that the Child Independent Care didn't. So that's why they came up with a new credit. Very quickly, the both credits were put into one bill. They were both made refundable. There was questions about whether they should be refundable. Refundable means you get the full credit regardless of your tax liability. And I can still remember walking down the hall with Ken Baker one day, and he said, I don't think we can make them refundable, Shakatov. And I said, well, give us time, Senator. I think you'll understand why they need to be. Mm-hmm. And the reason they need to be is because most credits have carry forwards. And a carry, if you don't can't use it, you can carry it forward 5 years. But low and moderate income people don't have accountants who can keep track of that, and it's prone to error. And it also means you're not getting the full credit. And so if you really want to say you're going to give a poor working family a child care credit, give them the full credit, make it refundable like the federal earned income tax credit is. So they came around, and they designed it within the $100 million cost to be refundable on both, for both of them. And it passed the Senate 30 to zip. Very few votes I can remember, but that's one because it was so easy to remember. That one, then it goes over to the House. Then in the May forecast came out, and this is one of the few times I've ever seen a headline about the May forecast on the day of it coming out. Somehow it got leaked to the Oregonian and others. And Brady Adams was quoted in the Oregonian saying, oh, we have all this extra money. I want to move my tax credit forward 2 years. Mm. Now it's going to compete with all the funding. And that was the head, that was in the story. And the lobby that works in Ways and Means Committee was up in arms. Shakatov, you're taking our money. You're taking $100 million of money. And I tried to convince Brady shouldn't do that, Senator Adams, excuse me. And but they did it, and it, so the next version of the bill passed, moving the startup date, and they lost a bunch of votes, mostly Democrats, if not all Democrats. Mm-hmm. So then it went to the House, where they had some hearings and waited, but it waited until the end of session budget deal. And late on a Friday night, in the old House caucus room, came out. People came out around 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night, and then House Revenue Chair Tom Bryan came over to me and said, you know that $100 million deal that Brady has? We have to make it fit like a $30 or $40 million hole. I can't remember. It's much less. 8 a.m. tomorrow, we'll slice it up. And so they sliced it. They scaled back the credits that morning. The next morning, they made them non-refundable and changed some of the rates and whatnot and pushed out the bill, and the bill passed. So then that meant that those of us who liked the working family credit, we wanted it refundable, and we wanted the rate, the income levels restored. I think they had changed the income levels and percentages. And so that happened a couple sessions later. And then we also then we turned to getting the earned income credit made responsible. So why did we do this when we had an employment-related daycare program? Mm-hmm. Well, we did it because the employment-related daycare program has always been a very small program. Back then, it didn't have a waiting list. It was just one of the best-kept secrets in the Department of Human Services. Mm-hmm. I used to remind people that when we added 140,000 people to the Oregon Health Plan in 1994 and 1995 when it rolled out, they didn't get a letter from the Department of Human Services saying, welcome to the department, poor working family. If you have child care needs, you know, you should come to us too for that because we have a program for you. They didn't tell people about it. Mm-hmm. And pretty much most in the statistics you got from Chris the other day show, you know, most of the people come from the ADC or TANF program. Mm-hmm. That's because they're the only one who know about it. And a lot of people don't want to go to the department for child care who say, I don't need welfare, so why should I go to the child care department, to the agency, to Department of Human Services? So it was always small and was always having budget crunch and never getting enough money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's, since then, and now it has a waiting list. It's not a true waiting list. They open and close the waiting list, so it's not like it's not an indicator of what demand is. It's whether or not it's open. People find out it's open to get on it. And so the working family credit's very efficient at getting the money out to the families. There's very little bureaucracy or administration to do so. It's an efficient process. Does it meet people's needs? Totally, absolutely not. What's one of the shortcomings? Your needs for childcare are monthly, paycheck to paycheck. right? Or weekly, or it's paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
And so a child care credit doesn't solve that problem. But back, we did not have a sunset on it, and I was an advocate for sunsets, but I was a lawyer at the time and a zealous advocate for my clients, and it was not in my client's interest to put a sunset on it, so I didn't mention that little friendly amendment. But now it does, but now it's guaranteed for 6 years, mm-hmm. right? And we knew it would be harder to get rid of a credit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll be honest with you. But it plays a vital role because... and why you should support extending the sunset, because the ERDC program,
mm-hmm.
and I know you have other bills that are going to look into improving it and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
I don't think, frankly, the money's there to make it as universal as the working family credit, where it could offset it and do that. I mean, it's just a big, different process.
Mm-hmm.
And so the shortcoming that it comes out at the end, you know, that is a shortcoming of it, but it recognizes that for people who are in ERDC, they have a copay, and they also, some of them have pay above the copay,
mm-hmm.
and it really recognizes that most of the population who have people who have children in childcare are not in the ERDC program.
Mm-hmm.
So right now it's about 8,500 to 9,000 families.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so that's why, and so that's. That's why they went ahead and did it. And so you need both and. Does the ERDC program need improvement? When you get to that bill, we'll talk about why it does and mm-hmm. how to improve it. But the Working Family Credit has really proven vital to thousands of Oregonians.
Okay. That's great. That's great context. Any questions about the Working Family Tax Credit? Then... thank you for your testimony.
Oh,
sir.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Caught me off guard there.
Yeah.
Chair Kenny Gayer, thank you. When we talk about the grandma, grandpa, aunts, uncles doing the babysitting and somebody's probably paying for that, what is the process for them to show receipt of that? Do they actually have a receipt of it or do they just claim it?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative, I think you can call the department back. There are requirements for having proof of it, and the department, frankly, does do a lot of reviews.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they call them audits. They have a different term. I don't know if review is the right term, of working families. There's actually a disproportionate. I follow Oregon tax court decisions that show up on a national tax newsletter, and there's sort of a disproportionate number of working family child care credit tax court cases. Some of them actually go there. So they are required to have proof of payment.
So my question is, it doesn't have to be in a licensed daycare facility. Is that
Representative Kenny Geyer, Chair Geyer, and Representative Hay, that's correct. I don't believe they have to be, and that was one of the reasons that they wanted to make it more flexible, for knowing that a lot of folks weren't in the ERDC program, which has to be one of the ERDC-approved daycare providers. So that's why they did it.
So any of these technical questions... Chris, I'll call you up at the very end in case there's any clarification that you want to do. So feel free to ask and answer to the extent you can, and then we'll close out with you at the very end. So, another question?
Chuck, you may not know the answer to this, but of the 650,000 Oregonians living in poverty, what percentage are children or families with children?
I don't know if that's in the paper that's online. I forgot to bring my paper copy of it. That I can tell you that of families with children who are in poverty, 70% have a worker in the household who work either full time or part time in the prior year,
mm-hmm.
part of the year. And so, if you want to consider who's poor and working, that's sort of the. And there's a paper on the materials, Working But Poor, Working But Still
yes,
Poor.
Yes, I couldn't find it in that paper.
So I can get you that. You want to know the percentage of the 600 and something thousand who are?
Either children or...
Or parents. Adults with children.
Or adults with children.
Okay, we can get you that.
Well, thank you for your testimony. We're going to call. Oh, one more question, sorry.
Yeah, thank you, Sheriff. If I can respond to Rep. Hayden's question, to my understanding, so maybe someone can correct me, when you report that you've paid a grandparent or, you know, a relative and so forth on your taxes, it does request who, you know, their mailing address, their name, and their either their tax ID or their Social Security number, so that it can be checked. Whether it is followed up on, I don't know, but I know they do collect that information on those individuals.
No K-1.
Yep. Okay, well, thank you for your testimony. I'd like to
thank
call others up for 2115, John Mullen, Eva Ripito, and Kate Newell.
Proprietor.
Hmm? Newhall. Newhall.
Proprietor, unless it's a center, and then the center would have to be an LLC.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I'm also going to provide a little bit of context in my testimony, but I'll be brief. The Oregon Law Center, for those of you not familiar, works on access to justice for low-income communities. And so part of my role working with the Oregon Law Center is to look at tax expenditures and the two sides of the coin. One side is about the benefit that goes to low-income people, because that's what we're concerned about. And the other side of the coin is to make sure that we have an adequate budget, because every dollar we spend through the tax code is a dollar that we don't have for the budget. So we are supportive of 2115, and I would just point out that 86% of the population of filers are below $46,400. The Department of Revenue does everything in quintiles. So this is really seems to be appropriately targeted for populations that are really needing this kind of assistance. I just will switch for a moment to a quick discussion about being co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee. I was one of the founders of the Human Services Coalition back in the 1980s. I go back to the beginning of time sometimes. It feels like that. We got together, and earlier on, when I first came to the legislative session in 1979, I testified before a committee like this, and I thought, well, that's how the legislature works. And then I found out there was something called the Ways and Means Committee that worked on budgets, and I said, oh, that's how the legislature worked. And then I found out there were revenue committees that, as I'm working on budget, they're busy shoveling money out the back door through the tax code. So these are things that are really very much present in the discussion. And I have to say that the legislature has paid a lot more attention to tax expenditures in recent years. We advocated, along with others, about the creation of the first tax expenditure report back in 1995. We also advocated for the sunsetting of tax expenditures, which then led to the discussion in the bill that has these sunsets on tax credits. We would still like a deeper discussion about that someday, about looking at all the various tax expenditures. And then just to add just a quick note about that and putting it in context is that we are looking at, as I know you are here to talk about the policy implications of these tax credits that are before you. But meanwhile, the backdrop of all of this is that, as you know, the co-chairs have come out with their budget. And as Chris has mentioned, there's $64 million in expiring tax credits, and there's $14 million that is allocated for not only the expiring tax credits, but for anything that might be done that's new. And so that's going to be an interesting challenge. But Human Services Coalition really encourages that there be a deeper dive in looking at tax expenditures in general. So I just would say that the one thing that I want to end with is that I want to express appreciation. We advocated for the position in legislative revenue, and we were delighted that Chris Allenack moved over to take that position. And then we've also worked very closely with the Department of Revenue, so I also want to thank Deanna Mack. Without having the kind of technical information both the Legislative Revenue Office provides and also the Department of Revenue, there's not transparency. And so I think what we've been doing over the last number of legislative sessions is moving towards greater and greater transparency and greater accountability about tax expenditures. Thank you.
Thank you. Are you in favor of 2115?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, both the Oregon Law Center and the Human Services Coalition of Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Eva Ripito. I'm political coordinator with AFSCME Council 75. And we, in Oregon, we represent licensed in-home child care providers, also known as family child care. So you hear about them in the, they're part of the broad spectrum of child care that we have in the state. Thank you for the opportunity. My comments that I've constructed kind of encompass both 2091 and 2115, so it kind of blends together, and I apologize. But I wanted to say you've all heard in the discussions that child care is difficult to afford in Oregon. And as we look at ways to continue the professional development of our child care providers and the quality of the settings for our children, affordability and access are going to be a bigger part of the discussion. So we see expanding the Working Families Child Care Tax Credit, as well as employment-related daycare, which you'll discuss on Monday, as both very important pieces in helping families make ends meet. With the wait list for employment-related daycare, this tax credit is even more important for families in need, because when you're trying to make ends meet, every little bit helps. On a regular basis, I hear from child care providers that get a phone call from a parent who is so excited that they have been offered a job and they're looking for child care. And it comes to the point of discussing what the rates are, and they're just devastated because they realize that up to half of their income is going to go to care. And this is for settings that are even the more affordable settings. You know, so they say, what am I to do? And the child care provider says, do you have friends, family? How, you know, like, I don't know. They try to help them in every way they can. They suggest employment-related daycare. They tell them about tax credits. But we need to do more to help families make ends meet. I should also say that the cost is not because child care providers are raking in the cash. As you've heard, for center employees, the average is $10 to $14 an hour. And for licensed in-home care, that rate is even smaller. We don't know for sure because they don't have to report for themselves, and you know, it's difficult to track, but we can say with certainty that the average wage for an in-home provider is less than a center employee's. So I just wanted to say that AFSCME, and I personally believe investing in child care is a hand up for more than one person. It creates multi-level impact. The child who gets quality care, the parent who gets stable care for their child so they can work, and the provider who is able to support her or himself, their families, and their small business. So I urge you both, or urge you all to support both the expansion and the extension. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I am representing Family Forward. And I want to thank you for the opportunity. I also kind of mushed my testimony together, so sorry about that. But thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2115. Family Forward Oregon supports the Working Family Child Care Tax Credit, as well as making it a larger benefit for working families. We know that families struggle with the really high cost of child care, and we believe that this tax credit is critical, and particularly critical for low-income families. Family Forward as an organization is committed to advancing policies that help families succeed both in the workplace and at home. And our mission is to create a more family-friendly Oregon where families aren't forced to choose between their work responsibilities and their home responsibilities and can still be economically secure. So it's no surprise, you guys have heard it before, that childcare is far, far too expensive and really unaffordable for many Oregonians. And just to put that a little bit into perspective, I have some stats. And this is from a 2013 report that the University of Oregon did that found that the median cost of childcare can be nearly twice as much as tuition at a public university. So it was $11,000 per year for a toddler childcare versus just under $6,700 a year for college tuition. So I sort of make the joke that it's like more expensive than college, but you don't get 18 years to save up for it. We also know that childcare is one of the biggest budget items for working families. So for a two-parent family, childcare is an average of 18% of their annual income. And for a single parent, it's 61.6% of their annual income. We also know that maternal poverty rates are really high, especially for women with young children. Being able to access childcare lifts both moms and children out of poverty. And beyond just the immediate affordability impacts, we also believe that it's really important to make sure that families can afford quality childcare. And don't think that affordability should be the only factor when parents are considering what childcare provider to choose. We know that quality early learning programs help children succeed later and in the long run, and that the early years are a very unique period of development. So we need to ensure that we have both high quality and affordable childcare. And it's for, I guess, in closing, for these reasons, that Family Forward supports both renewing the tax credit and increasing it.
Sure. Okay, questions? Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Kate, you mentioned a study by the University of Oregon. Where or who on the campus put that out? And
it's actually Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Parrish. If you look at my written testimony that I submitted, it's cited at the bottom of it. It was a study called Child Care and Education in Oregon and Its Counties, 2012, published by the Oregon State University in 2013.
Do you know a department, though, like who put that out?
I'm sure I could get that information for you.
Thank you.
I will venture to guess it's Bobby Weber at the Office of Family Child Care. You're highly likely.
I'm really interested in that. That'd be great.
Yep. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you for the report, discussion, and the history. You know, it's interesting, though, all the discussion today has been centered around, and rightfully so, around the cost of child care. But, you know, in terms of dollars, and I just want to emphasize, and you did kind of bring it up a bit, the actual emotional cost, the stress, the real capacity that child care really provides parents for staying healthy and being able to work and provide that kind of resource.
Thank you. Representative Beeler?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I'm very much a supporter of child care tax credits. But how would access and affordability be affected if we increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Beeler, I don't have an answer for that offhand, but that's something also the Human Services Coalition of Oregon has been supportive of raising the minimum wage. This goes back historically, even before the minimum wage was indexed. And we often talk about the interplay between tax credits and raising the minimum wage. So, for example, as a separate example, we've been supportive both of increasing the earned income tax credit and the minimum wage because it really is difficult as households that have lower income, they really do struggle with having both low wages and then being able to access benefits like the working family tax credit and earned income tax credit makes sense. But I don't have a direct answer to your question.
Don't you think it'd become more expensive if we increase the minimum wage?
Madam Chair, Representative Beeler, I basically, just in thinking about our position from the Human Services Coalition, we're supportive of both, but I don't have an analysis like that to say how the expense would land.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Beeler, thanks for letting me jump in on this too. AFSCME is also trying to figure this out, our providers. You know, they're very supportive of increasing minimum wage for the families, and then yet also see how this might impact, you know, the cost of their services. And I would actually venture to say that the cost is kind of low right now, because especially for the in-home providers, they know that their families are struggling to make ends meet. And when you talk to them about why don't you increase your rates to, you know, because they're trying to make ends meet too, they say, I can't because my families can't afford it. So it's It's a really difficult conversation to have, but I think it's necessary. And I think that as we look at programs that help families and help the system, that will, you know, that these are valuable investments for those reasons, that we're going to be lifting up the people that are, you know, helping educate and form our youngest and the families that need a hand up as well.
Yeah, can I just follow up? Maybe I'm not. I agree. But if we increase the cost of delivering a service, how can it not make it less affordable? It's a pretty simple equation, right?
Yeah. That might be an argument for the expansion.
Don't we just inflate away the advantages of the tax credit if we increase the minimum wage?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Bueller, there are also opportunities to look at expanding the employment-related daycare. So, and again, this is an interesting kind of discussion about thinking about public policy, spending through the tax code, or spending through tax credits. And so I think it really warrants some deeper discussion.
So just a quick editorial comment. I see you there.
Okay.
If child care workers are making more money, they're not struggling to offer a service while they're in poverty themselves.
Right.
Those that are bringing their children to child care would also be getting the increase in minimum wage, so hopefully would not be struggling as well. If we kept the tax credits exactly as is, it's true you're not really gaining, which I think is one of the reasons why we're considering expansion. But I do think that looking at that cliff, if we take the hypothetical raise in minimum wage, then what would it take to make sure that families still end up not bearing a greater, you know, they're going to make a little more, they're going to have to give a little more. Where does that end us up with these tax credits? Those are really important questions.
Thank you. That's kind of
Representative Hayden.
Thank you. Chair Kinnegar. When the child care tax credits are available for the parents, I think, at least for me, what we're trying to do is help the child. And child doesn't have the ability to help mom and dad plan their taxes and how they're going to spend that tax return when it comes around. And, you know, it's April and spring, and maybe we get that boat or that jet ski. And so my concern with a lot of these things has been, I got my first public check today. I won't show it to you all, but it's the first time I've ever been employed by a government agency. And there's a whole list of, you know, Social Security tax, taxes taken out of it. My question is, and we can claim, or these families can claim, you know, 1, 2, 3 children, but why can't they claim monthly a child care credit here, so every month that doesn't come out of their paycheck, so that the daycare is able actually to get the money? Because the daycare can't wait 12 months to get that money. Some of these parents don't manage the money perfectly, and it seems like if we can put all these lines on here to take money out of our paychecks, yet we still have that tax credit, if we could put that in monthly so they had the money that month, that child would get much better chance of staying in the daycare that month. Is that a possibility?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, that's been a discussion, for example, with the Earned Income Tax Credit about making it available monthly. It's been talked about as being a burden on employers to do that kind of work. But I think, actually, that gets at the heart of the discussion that when we talk about these cliffs that happen and the way benefits work, is that if we make it possible for people to get money and or services on a regular basis rather than waiting for a whole year, it's certainly, for reasons that you mentioned, it's better for the family. But again, that's a big and important discussion. Thanks for the question.
Well, I think business and labor would be happy to work with you if there was some offset for their small costs to do that, because that's a pretty tiny payroll change to add that back in with very little costs. Anyway.
Because out of the Employment Taxes, you take out the Employment Act taxes, you're the state.
Yeah. Well, thank you to the panel. Please stick around so you can come back and continue with the future public hearing. And can I call up Brenda Durbin, please? Thank you for being so patient.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geiser, members of the committee. My name is Brenda Durbin. I'm the Director of Clackamas County Social Services, and I'm here representing the Clackamas County Department of Health, Housing, and Human Services. And we do support House Bill 2115, also 2091. That'll come up a little bit later. In large part because what we see our families struggling every day that we work with throughout the department. So as we learn more about how young brains develop, we gain a greater understanding and appreciation of the importance of the early childhood environment. We know that an early childhood rich in love, attention, nutrition, and enriched environments is great for the brain. And those kids who have adverse early childhood experiences, that can really stay with them all of their lives. So anything that can help working families afford quality child care is something that the county really supports and we feel should be a priority for the state. And as we've heard before, child care is so expensive. For many households, it can be almost as much as they pay for their rent. So we need to help folks find a way to afford child care. And again, quality child care, as has been mentioned before. Child care is important for the child. It's also really important for the parents, as someone mentioned a little bit ago. When you're at work and you know that your child is safe, you can focus on your work, you can focus on your education if you're in school, and you don't have to worry about what's happening with your child. So we feel that quality child care is important for the child and is equally important for the parents so they can succeed in their jobs. And then finally, I would just like to share an experience from a coworker that I heard about the other day. She's a county employee, so she makes, you know, a pretty decent wage. But she was unexpectedly had to accept responsibility for her grandchild. And so she was a bit shocked to find the child care bill at $800 a month. This woman actually had some savings that she was able to tap into that allowed her to afford the type of child care. Again, that she needed that would enable her to focus at work and know that her grandson was well taken care of. She accessed the Working Family Tax Credit, and it helped replenish her savings and helped her maintain that financial stability that she needed to care for her grandchild for many years until the mom came back into the picture. So it's a really important program. It's important for all of us to make sure that the early childhood years are a positive experience for our kids, because we all pay for them down the road when the kids don't get what they need. And anything the state of Oregon can do, whether it's through a tax credit or through EDRC, to help make sure that every working family can afford quality child care is something that we would strongly support. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for Brenda?
Yeah. Yep. Brenda, you've spent years working with people in poverty. Mm-hmm. In your observations, what are the main drivers of poverty in the state of
poverty?
Oregon?
It's really such an individual experience. Low wages are a big driver. If folks earned more, they wouldn't be so poor. The high cost of everyday expenses, housing, medication, food, as all of that rises, it makes it harder for folks to make ends meet. And for some folks, poverty happens when they lose a job, when they get ill and they can no longer work. So it's really a variety of different things coming together. Many folks are able to work out of poverty, but most folks do require a little bit of support to get them to a place where they can meet the needs of their family.
Any other questions? So, Brenda, stay for a minute. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on 2115? Marilee, would you like to come up and testify? Brenda, I thought you might want to stay.
Are you going to move right to 91?
I am going to right after. It looks like we may have one more person. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Is she testifying?
Are you testifying on 2115?
Yes. My name is Marilee Haas. And I, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm representing the Oregon Association for the Education of Young Children. We're a statewide organization of people that work in a variety of settings with children from birth through age 8. And we're committed to the well-being of young children, and I appreciated the remarks of Representative Hayden about the reason we're doing this is to benefit the children in their settings and consistency for them. And I believe that House Bill 2115, with continuing the child care tax credit, really will help parents, whatever their circumstances, but it especially affects lower middle income parents that may not qualify for the employment-related daycare program, to be able to bridge that gap and to have a little bit. I'm intrigued by the idea of it being refundable, but having tax credits as part of the strategy that we as a state offer to our families really does make a difference for children and families. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Really.
With that, hold on, and I will close the public hearing on 2115 and open the public hearing on 2091. And because you are there, would either of you like to comment on 2091, the expansion and refundable version of 2115?
I believe that the expansion really would make a big difference. Again, you have to look at the revenue balance, but the amount that the credit is now, as you've received the figures, just is not sufficient really to help families as much as they need. The cost of their child care is expensive, and additional dollars coming to them or a refundable option really could make a big difference.
Chair Geyer, members of the committee, yes, Clackamas County also supports House Bill 2091. Everything is getting more expensive. Our housing is getting more expensive. Our food is getting more expensive. Wages, particularly for lower income earners, are not keeping pace. And so any opportunity to increase the tax credits available through the Working Family Tax Credit Program, I think would play a really critical role in helping working families meet their basic needs, maybe socks a little bit away, savings for education, and really make a difference for people for whom, you know, a few hundred dollars a year really is significant.
Thank you. And could you each state your name for the record again, just because it's on a different bill?
Brenda Durbin, Director of Clackamas County Social Services.
Marilee Haas, Executive Director of Oregon Association for the Education of Young Children.
Thank you. Any questions?
Just
2091.
Okay, Kenny Geyer, thank you. Yeah, on the refundable question, I think you got the point that what I'm saying is I would like that money left in their paycheck,
right,
so they have it monthly to pay their daycare provider so that kid gets the benefit, rather than waiting till April 15 and get a big chunk of refundable money that probably is not going to be managed for the next 12 months of daycare. So I don't know how that process works, but it seems like there could be an adjustment in the tax so that was monthly spread out for them, projected, rather than retroactively after a year of taxes, and then hope that money gets to daycare.
Madam Chair, if I might comment.
Please.
Marilee Haas, again, for the record. I believe your revenue advisors could advise you on that, but there already is the federal earned income tax credit, which does have a refundable provision which can come out of their paycheck. So it would be a comparable system, I would assume.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. So anyone that has, let's see, we'll call up people, feel free to come up again. Some of you expressed your feelings about 2091, but if you'd like to come up again for the record,
I need to call them.
Chuck Shekatoff, Kate Newhall, and Eva Repito.
You first?
Yep.
Chuck Shekatoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy. So we're in support of having it increase if the money is available. It'll also add a sunset, extend the sunset on it, so it's not just a one-year bill. Mm-hmm. But I would like to just take a moment to address Representative Hayden's question on the advance payment. There was with the federal EITC an advance payment. You could get a portion of it, not 1/12, but like 40% of it on a monthly basis, and it was. rarely used by people. Businesses didn't like it, and this is all before QuickBooks was as popular as it is now. But even then, they with paycheck services, they didn't like it. I believe the federal government got rid of the advance payment. The reason the state one didn't have it, they debated whether we should have it on the state level because it was on the federal, is the government's at risk if that you calculate how much you think the person's going to get, and on this would be how much they're going to spend on child care over the course of the year, and then you're giving them some money ahead of it. The way the federal government sort of, I think, rationalized it, and the reason it was like 40% was because we know we're getting FICA out of the families, maybe not income tax, and so they were sort of covered by that, where the state really isn't covered by those payments. So that's, and there was financial risk. Legislative council didn't want it to be in there either. So that's why the EITC and the Working Family Credit did not have advance payments when they were created years ago.
Maybe our kids are worth the risk.
And then just another thing about the sort of end of, but the end of year issue is an issue, but you know, I think, and I should have mentioned this earlier. Back when in the day, there was when you're on ADC, you could get, if you had an emergency, you could get aid to dependent children. Thank you, Chair Kindergarten. You could get an emergency assistance payment if you had an emergency in your family. And you can only do it once every 12 months. And the Department of Human Services used to call it the 13th welfare payment, that people would keep track of when they had a problem. And then they'd wait, and they'd do that because they were always behind on their bills. And so what the Working Family Credit does is, you may have borrowed money for child care, and then you're going to pay off. Or maybe you're a working poor family, and you were told when you had your, 6 months ago when you had a flat fixed by Les Schwab, you should get new tires, but you couldn't afford them. Well, when you get your tax credit, refundable tax credit, you can go out and buy those new tires, right? Or a new uniform for work or whatever. So it's that type of, it's work-related. It gets spent in the economy, and it just goes to deferred costs that families are able to defer, whether it's a back payment on a utility bill or new tires or whatever. So thank you and the opportunity.
And would you like to address one another one? You said yes. You support both refundable and expansion and extend it to the 6 year.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, Kate Newhall with Family Forward Oregon. And I'm happy to testify in support of 2091. It's something that we feel like increasing the Working Families Child Care Tax Credit will help families obtain both affordable and quality child care, which I think is really important. And I think that ensuring that families have access to both high-quality child care and affordable child care is crucial to maintaining an economically stable and competitive workforce in Oregon, both now and going into the future.
Okay.
Chair.
Yep.
Chuck, I hate to add to your burden of getting me data, but how much demographic data do you have on the 650,000 people who are in poverty in Oregon in terms of age, sex, household, that type of thing?
So the two papers that are in the record are what we've published, but we can get you other information. So, and I want to be clear, you wanted to know the. So you want to send me a letter
and
have all the list of questions, right? Sure. You wanted to have the number of children out of that 600,000 or so,
yeah.
And you wanted to know the number of adults who are parents of those children.
Yeah, I'll send you a letter. So, thank you.
Maybe demographics on geography.
Yeah, I want to know as much about those 650,000 people as they exist in terms of demographic data.
Sure.
Okay, Eva?
Thank you, Chair Kinney-Geyer and members of the committee. Again, I'm Eva Ripito with Oregon AFSCME Council 75. We are supportive of House Bill 2091. I was like, is that one we're here?
Yes.
Yes, expanding the child care tax credit is hugely important for having families be able to access child care. I would even go out on a limb and say, if we could do even more, that would be even more helpful. I mean, so many families are trying so hard to make ends meet, and when you have a child care bill ranging from, depending on the area, $550 to $1,800 a month, that's a big burden. So we should do what we can to help families. Thanks.
Question.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I'm not sure who the best one to answer this is, so if we need to defer to somebody else to answer this, that's fine. But I'm looking at with 29 to 1, if we were to double that amount, so at the highest eligibility based off of the chart, you know, our first illustration with a household size of 3 says that share of eligible expenses allowed is 40%. And then from there, we're talking about doubling that, so someone could receive 80% according to 2091. And then if we have the earned income, or sorry, the one we're hearing on Monday.
ERDC,
thank you. Which is 50%, is it likely that we could end up with someone having 100% paid between all of those, by the time you stack those?
I don't think ERDC is 50%, but.
Yeah, I don't. Madam Chair, Representative Stark. So you have to think about the hydraulics on it, frankly. So if someone's in getting child care, and most of the people with child care are not in the employment-related daycare program. So if you increase the basic credit from 40% to 80%, they're going to get 80% of their cost back. That's what you'd be doing. So now take the very few people who are in the employment-related daycare program. Let's say the child care, when you're in the employment-related daycare program, the state calculates how much of a subsidy they're going to pay based on the zip code of the provider and the age of the children and the type of care setting, whether it's center to family care, okay, so the range. And they have a figure. So let's just hypothetically say they're going to pay $500. Then they look at the family and they say, what's your family size and income? And based on that, you have a copay. Okay? And so your copay might be $100. When you go to file for the earned income tax for the working family child care credit, it's just that $100 that gets affected by it. Okay, so you'd get 40% of that $100. You wouldn't, and under the bill, you'd get 80% of it.
It's only the child care expenses that you end up paying.
That you pay, right. And then if, however, your ERDC is going to pay, says, and then what happens is you pay your $100. The state's only sending $400 to the provider. They're saying the rate for that provider in that zip code, that age kid, that type of provider is $500. You pay $100, they pay $400. If that provider raises their rates to $600, you're now paying $200. The state's still paying their $400, and that's how it goes. But you're getting the credit on what you pay out. So that's the interplay. So when the minimum wage goes up, most people aren't in the ERDC program. When their minimum wage goes up, they'll eventually be in the lower percentiles under the working family child care credit. You won't be in that 40%. If your income goes up, your credit will go down. If you're in ERDC, what typically can happen is your credit will go down, but your copay will go up even more. So you lose out on that.
Right. Can I do a follow-up? So, but we're discussing increasing the exit poverty level on the ERDC to 250%. So I'm doing the math off. If someone is paying $10,000 a year in child care expenses, and if they end up with a 50% copay, that's $5,000 a year they're paying, because it is possible to receive up to the 50%. And then if we pay 80% of that, $5,000 out of that $10,000, it factors out to they pay $1,000 out of the $10,000 total child care in that scenario.
I'm missing. I don't know where the 50% comes from. I'm not familiar with that. And so, you know, if you raise on the ERDC side, if you raise the income level and adjust the copay, you're going to have a copayment schedule is going to go out to there, and the state's going to be paying a portion of the child care, an increasingly smaller portion of it as the copay goes up, and then. The family is going to then be also at a higher level and lower percentage of the earned income tax credit. At 250%, they're not eligible for the working family child care credit. That gets rid of the eligibility on both bills. So
this may be a continued discussion on Monday as we look at the two together.
Exactly. Okay. We're trying to figure out how all the pieces fit together.
Representative Hayden.
Sure, Kenny Geyer. Just one quick comment on risk. It's the people's money to begin with anyway. So if you could figure out to where that came through their paycheck monthly, that they got that credit there, all you're doing is not taking money out of their paycheck. You're not actually writing, at least in my concept, not writing them back a check. You're saying you got to pay X amount less on your taxes this month, so you have that money for daycare. That was my point. Not that you're fronting them money. No, maybe you look at it differently. No, it's not.
Madam Chair, Representative, I understand. I think. I think one of the issues is I'm not so sure people who have child care costs are given good tax advice about how many exclusions to take on that form you fill out with your employer, and you can just add another exclusion if you're expecting to have a child care credit, and less will be taken out, you know. And there's some rules on that, and the folks with DOR and LRO can explain that. But I think it's hard because of whether or not you're eligible, right? You know, you might say to your employer, I have child care this month, but next week you're not using it. And your employer doesn't know that, but they have to keep changing their payroll system. So, yeah, but that's the sort of complicated aspect of it.
The kids have a funny habit of turning from 4 to 5, from 5 to 6, from 6 to 7, and so we pretty much know the family that is probably going to qualify for that already.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else to testify on 2091? If not, I will close the public hearing on 2091 and open up the public hearing on 2113. And could you please read us the...
Certainly, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2113 extends tax credit sunset for Office of Child Care contributions. It may have a revenue impact, no statement issued yet. May have a fiscal impact, no statement yet issued. And there is a subsequent referral to joint tax.
Okay, can I please call up Chuck Shekatoff and John Mullen? Is there anyone else that wants to testify on this one?
Okay. We have consensus. I'll go first then. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, John Mullen. And on this one, I'm here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition Tax and Revenue Committee because we don't have a position from the Oregon Law Center. I just also have to say, too, that after a long week, it's really interesting to have this kind of discussion here in this committee because there are so many complexities. Chuck used the word hydraulics. All of these things are interrelated. When you look through the tax expenditure report, and it's some interesting reading to put you to sleep at night. But you find all kinds of mysteries about where in the world did this come from. One of the things that Human Services Coalition advocated for was having a purpose statement for everything that we have as tax expenditure. And so that is true going forward. But some of the things that have existed in the past, you just don't know where they came from. And Chris is trying to do some detective work in his report to try to figure all of these things out. So this particular one is a little bit of a mystery to me. One of the things that happens in the tax expenditure report when you have a small number of people or businesses, the information is suppressed because they don't want anybody to figure out here's who's donating and here's the company that's involved. So this particular tax credit is capped at $500,000, and for all we know, it could be one person making this contribution, and there's a 75% tax credit. So, you know, basically, the Human Services Coalition thinks that this is one that's not targeted very well. It may have actually a good result in terms of enhancing quality of child care, but there may be, this is an example of one where there may be other ways of getting at the goal that we want to have. And obviously, you've heard from people who are have a lot more expertise in child care here this afternoon than I do, but we all know that child care is a crisis, and we've approached it from a number of different perspectives with policies, with spending in the budget, and spending through the tax code over the years, that it's really a whole bunch of mix and match and maybe even some mismatch kinds of issues that are going on. So the Human Services Coalition doesn't support this particular tax credit, but would like to see efforts and discussion towards meeting the goals not only of affordable child care, but also ways in which quality can be improved.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chuck Shekatoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy. I neglected to bring my historical look at the different tax expenditure reports pages on this one, but it's been very low number of people. I think only like 130 taxpayers, I think is in the most recent report. But it's a pretty significant tax credit. If you take the tax average tax credit that's in the tax expenditure report divided by 0.09, you'll see that they're getting tens of thousands of dollars of tax-free income. And when you recognize that someone with earning only around $15,000 is paying taxes in Oregon, you sort of say, wait, this might not make sense. What happens is it's creating a fund of about $1.3 million based on the 75% tax credits. Someone's giving $100 and getting 75 back. So they're giving $1.3 million and they're getting a million, they're giving away back a million. I think the department sent me some reports that are mentioned in the tax expenditure report about evaluations that have been done in the past. They've been used in some pilot projects in some states, in some counties. I haven't had a chance to read them all. I glanced at them quickly last night. I thank the department for sending me them. My feeling is, why have this sort of tax credit scheme for funding it? Just fund it at $1.3 million. If you think these are good programs and they should be, and they're so as good as the department says they are, education department, make them bigger, fund them more adequately. But instead of having little pilot projects, but to have this thing where 130 taxpayers are doing this little deal doesn't seem right if it's the right spending.
Okay, questions from anyone? Okay, then
thank
I
you.
Close the public hearing on 2113, and I believe we are adjourned.
If you don't want to hear Chris.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Do you have anything for Chris?
Chris, is there anything that you would like to come up and share? Are there questions for Chris? Or anything that came up technically that you want to address?
I just have one quick question.
Yeah.
For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. So do single parents get preference over, married couples in the program? Do you know? Does anyone know here?
In which program?
For the ERDC, for qualifying, does preference go to single parents over if they're paying such a higher percentage of their wages? I don't know if anybody here knows.
I'm not the correct person for the direct spending program.
I think
program.
You'll find out on Monday.
Find out on Monday. It's only income-based?
I believe so.
I thought maybe you knew because I thought it was based on income, maybe.
We'll make sure that we find that out before the hearing on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions for Chris? Okay, thank you. Thank you for everyone for bearing with us on Friday afternoon, and we are now adjourned.
Good of a merry cup.
Bearing with us on Friday afternoon, and we are now adjourned.